tell them that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to.
When I saw your work at Mamarind, you had held on to some of your first pieces.
Yes.
Tell me why you saved those first pieces.
It would make you laugh. The very first one I made was a flying goose. I no longer have it. I gave it away as a gift. Mm-hmm. The second piece I made, I called Mother Sun Holding a Turtle. Now everybody knows it's Mother Earth. So that was a mistake right off the bat, and I wouldn't make any more because I had already named it, and that was a one-of-a-kind mistake to me. But it was something I wanted to keep because I was just playing with it. And further to that, there was a circle for the sun in it, and I wasn't confident enough in doing a circle in rows. So, okay, the second picture I did was the Tree of Peace, and it also has a sun behind it. But in this one, I did attempt it, and my circle is quite wobbly. You can see it in the picture. But I keep those pictures to keep me humble. I really do. I look at them and I think, oh, someday you'll get better, but keep trying, you know. And I found over the while, I'm not afraid to do circles anymore. I mean, they come out fairly reasonable now. But I keep the first one of all of my work. All of my work, the very first one I make of any design, and I usually give them to my children or keep them myself. I've got my first large spiritual done, and it's pretty rough looking, but it hangs in my living room, and I'm proud of it. But it's, if you want to look at it real close, it's pretty rough looking. I've learn to mix my colors a little better and to get the beading itself smoother. And I'm still learning at that because I find every once in a while I still get a little ripple in it. But once it's framed, you can't see it anyway. And it doesn't, it still takes just as much work to complete the picture. But like I say, and I figure maybe as time goes by, I'm having a limited edition in my pictures. I haven't decided yet on my spiritual dawn how many. The first figure that came to my head was 100. I'll make 100 and I'm not making any more. What I'm hoping will happen is that they'll become more valuable as I find better beads and I get a little better color scheme to it. And I get a little more fluent in the way I sew it, and it'll flatten out better and it'll look like what I want it to look like. I hope to have each one of my pictures developed that by the time I have the end of my limited edition in it. Like my Bear Clan Peace Pipe, it's going to be a limited edition of 10. Now, I've made 2 already. I've got 2 in the process of that I'm starting to do. And the fourth and the fifth one, no, the fifth and the sixth one, I've changed the feather in it into an eagle feather. So you see, I'm changing it, and I hope to have it developed to its highest potential by the time I get to 10. And that's changing the background color, whatever I feel needs. So I hope by the time I get to number 10, I'll have it developed to what I really wanted.
When you first started your pictures, like usually when I do my bead work, I usually have things come to me when I'm sleeping, just like you say. Is that what happened with your pictures? Do you have like almost like dream visions of different things?
That's interesting when you say dream visions, because to me a dream vision is something that you have before you're actually asleep. You're thinking, like I can go to bed, and I think it's the nicest possible way to fall asleep. When I'm working on something, or if I want to do something like my Bear Clan Peace Pipe, I had it half done for about 3 months before I got the courage to try the feathers, before I actually completed it. I would go to bed and I would imagine, and I could see it vividly, of how I wanted it to look, but I wasn't confident enough to say I could actually do it. Well, that happens with any of my beadwork. Like if I have a barrette partially finished or anything, if I go to bed, you're like, your dream vision is something I feel like you're imagining something, like your design or whatever, your beads, and you can almost complete them. You can complete them in your dream vision. And to actually have dreams, and like, I don't dream of designs, I see designs in my dreams. And they don't actually have a meaning until I give it a meaning. But I can't tell you, I can't sit here and tell you this, this, and this I dreamed about, because that wouldn't be true. I've never really strictly kept track of that. It's just something that happens.
You yourself, do you feel that the beadwork is dying out, the beadwork itself?
Well, I thought that for the longest while, but it might have just been because I wasn't involved in it and I didn't know anybody and I didn't go to powwows and look at it, or I didn't do any of these sort of things. But now that I'm involved in it, I am just amazed how many people do it. You know, and different styles, and I really appreciate that. I just love looking at beadwork, other people's work, and like I say, not so much for the designs as appreciation of the work put into it. I don't like copying designs. I just don't.
What can you do to maintain and preserve the beadwork? Be yourself.
Well, I have a friend on a reserve here, Martha French. She just came. In fact, she was my surprise visitor this morning. We're starting a craft committee on our reserve in our first meeting. That's what we were talking about. Our first meeting is going to be the 27th of June. And in this way, we're going to hopefully start classes on the reserve for the smaller ones who want to learn. And create a deeper interest in ourselves, in finding outlets, maybe learning, marketing, everything. And I could imagine it could become quite a committee if we can get some interested people in it. And within my own family, I've already taught my 6-year-old granddaughter to do daisy chains. Now, I was amazed at her. She started when she was 5. And her attention span is amazing. I mean, she could sit here with me and bead. The only problem with that is if she got stuck, she'd say, "Grandma, help me," and I'd have to stop my work and help her. So that sort of tried my patience a little. Because if you have to stop your work, that means you have to readjust yourself again to get back to it. And then part of you is always aware that you're watching somebody else do it. I think that's another reason why beaters like to be alone.
Do you feel that the future generations can benefit from doing beadwork? Or?
I really like my beadwork. To me, I'm hoping that it will eventually make me a living, something that I can not just be proud of, but it will make me a living. I'm not at all sure that that's how a person should feel about beadwork, because I, in another sense, I feel it's traditional. And I think that's why I give so much of my beadwork away, because I want to try and even it out a little bit. I want to keep some of that tradition so that it's passed around and given, so that that person can appreciate it in a different way rather than having to buy it or put a monetary value on it. it's really hard to say. Like the future generations, I think they will appreciate it, but because our world is changing like it is right now, I'm afraid that that's what it will end up, is just being a monetary value. I don't know how we can stop that. Like, see that? There's a funny thing, too. My children aren't involved in POWs. Neither am I, except to the extent that I've shown my work a few times. The beadwork that was done a long time ago was done for family members. Like a mother would make it for her, maybe something for her daughter to wear in her hair, something for her son to, a belt, whatever. Her husband, she kept her husband dressed nicely for ceremonies. She kept her own moccasins and her own dress, her own personal self fixed up with beadwork. And it was all a part of everyday living to her. It wasn't something that she looked to sell. I'm pretty sure way back then, though, they sold their beadwork. Maybe not in selling in a sense that we do, but maybe in trade for something, like if she wanted leather. Yeah, they'd barter. But I look at our young folks today, and I think about all the traditions that we've lost already. And I look at our young folks. I'm lucky here. I've got there's three high school buses that change right nearby here, so I see them every day. They walk up to the store, and I know a lot of them, and I watch them. And I think our people are losing their Indianness so fast. So, like, I don't know if the reserve means as much to them as they do a person of my generation or the older even. You hear so much today of taxation and abolishing reserves and whatnot. Well, that means us as Indian people are being lost. And I would hate to see, as much as I love my beadwork, I would hate to see that be the only thing left when there's so many other things.
What are the things that you most want to see your own children carry on that are a part of being Indian for them as their mother?
I think what I would like to see my children, my children are like a lot of children today, where it's a mixed up world and it's modern, it's fast, there's so many things to do, it's so easy, it seems like, to me to get into trouble. Mind you, I got into enough of it when I was young, but it wasn't easy. You had to work at it a little bit sometimes. But I'd like to see not so much the traditions. Like, I've got children who are fairly good artists, and if they develop themselves, they could become more than fairly good if they wanted to. But it isn't these visual things that I'd like to see for my children. It would be more the traditional values, the honesty, the things that were taught, the not being selfish, the traditional things taught by the old people before there was influences brought in about greed and I don't know how to put it so that it would not sound too judgmental.
Say it as you feel it.
Well, I don't, I just can't express that feeling. I can't. I wish it for my children, but I know they don't have it. And I know in a lot of ways that it's mostly the person who has the most influence on their life who has to hand that down. And even though they've attempted to, that doesn't mean they're going to do it. But that's what I'd like to see. I know on all reserves, if there was any way that these traditions could be brought back, I'd love to see that. If there could be a committee, let's say, set up for traditions. And the worst part of it is, I think on every reserve, before you start imposing a tradition, you have to learn what it is. And there was things that Native people taught their children from the time they were little. One of them was to keep quiet. Now that had its own value in a sense that if a child was quiet, they were listening more, and in that way they were learning. They used to talk about native people, mostly our men, being quiet and backward. That wasn't true. Their minds were working, but they weren't necessarily saying anything. But that didn't mean that they were stupid or unknowing or uncaring. It just meant they were taught from the time they were little to hide their emotions. I feel that way with myself. I look at the things I learned from my grandmother and my mother. These are the very things that I feel that I learned from them. And there's a lot more things that I could mention that I just can't express them. Someday maybe I can write them down, but I just can't express them. But there's a lot of traditional things I'm pretty sure that our people taught the children. Like they were, even when they were given Indian names, they were given a name when they were born because of something that happened around them or because of circumstances or whatever. But when they had their vision or when they came of age, they were given another Indian name. And that was given by the elders in the tribe who had watched that child develop to the age it was, 12, 13. And they could tell the strengths that person had. They could tell by watching him over the years. Maybe he was going to be a bow maker. Maybe he was going to be a great hunter. Maybe he was going to be a great warrior. They could see all these different things. Maybe he was going to be a medicine person. Maybe he was going to be an herbalist. They could see these things, and he was named accordingly. Now, I don't know how you could put that to our modern day society, but I'm pretty sure that it could still fit somehow without calling them warriors or spear makers or bow makers. But we still have our herbalists, we still have our medicine men, we still have men who are known for working in steel, we still have men who are good at woodwork, we still have people who are good at different things and could be named accordingly. And that's another tradition that I feel is too sad to lose.
But it's coming back.
Yes, it is.
It's coming back. Mm-hmm. It's coming back slow, but we're in a generation now where we're the teachers, and if we don't start teaching the things that we know, we're going to lose it.
Yeah.
And like, our time is now, and I remember back when it was said that in the fourth generation they were scared of losing it at that time, because this is the seventh generation, and this is the generation that matters the most, regardless if you don't see it as coming back, as long as you're there to teach it to anyone that comes into your house
Well, you'd be surprised. I think I have a nice circle of friends here. I don't go out a lot. I like my home. I like to stay home a lot. I've had to tell some of my friends to please leave me alone a little bit so I can do my beadwork right now, because I'm turning it into a business. But I have friends that I'm pretty sure that could tell you that they do come here, and we do tell stories about way back when, or maybe it's something that's fresh in my memory about a book I've just read, about a story that relates to something, or even just a story from the old days. I can remember staying up with my grandmother. I was my grandmother's pet. Now, there was six or seven of us kids all around all the time, but I was her pet. And I can remember once, it's just a funny story, I can remember once she used to make fry bread enough to last for 3 or 4 days, and she had roast pans just full of them. But she'd start after the kids went to bed, and she'd always let me stay up with her, you know. I'd stay up and I'd watch her. She'd be mixing this dough and getting her fry pan. She had two or three fry pans on the wood stove, and she'd start cooking. Usually the first two pieces, one was for her and one was for me. And I can remember the smell of that and her talking to me. I can't remember everything she said, but I can remember her saying the odd word here and there to me, and it didn't matter to me. I was just happy to be there and eat my piece of gunjan and watch her make bread for that would last for 3 or 4 days. And that's something like my kids could never imagine, or our friends, that, you know, the ones who sit here, and they can't imagine that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we run to the store and buy a loaf of bread now, and it was so wonderful to me. Even when I cook fry bread today, that's one of the things I remember. And it's something they never had. They don't even know. And there's all kinds of stories like that. Some of them not so nice, some of them funny, some, you know, all kinds.
The majority of the stories have lessons in them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what kind, whether they're funny, whether they're mean or sad, or they all got a meaning to every story that's been told.
I've written down quite a few of the, there are stories with morals most of the time, that like when I grew up in a city most of the time, but we used to come to the reserve to visit my aunt and uncle across the river in Oneida. And that's what I am originally, is Oneida, an Iroquois, an Indian. You can see it in my beadwork too. But they used to tell stories, and they were mostly to scare the kids into behaving. And they work, because you wouldn't catch me on a road at night. I mean, you never know if you got to a crossroad if the devil was going to be there playing his fiddle and willing to teach you how, or, you know. But those are the kind of things. And I wrote a lot of these stories down. I'm hoping someday maybe
well,
I'll
see,
do something with them.
That's the kind of thing, too, with the craft group. To be able to pull them down, even if they go into the band office library, to have those kinds of things there, to share for the school. If you were able to get a grant to publish some of it, I mean, I just think that's wonderful. Those are the kinds
I
of
don't know if I'll ever do anything with it, but I told my children, well, they'll be here. If you ever want them, they'll be here, and they can read them anytime.
That's good. Well, the only other thing is about materials. What that's like for you in terms of getting materials. Is it harder, easier, expensive?
It's hard and expensive. one reason is lack of transportation. Usually when I do sell my work, I like to turn part of it back into materials. There's only particular materials that I will use in my beadwork. Like, I won't just buy any kind of black velvet to back it. There's only a certain kind of frames I like to put my work in, and those are really hard to get. Sometimes I have to wait, and if I have to wait, my customer has to wait. And I would rather get to a position where I could get them readily. Mm-hmm. That's hard that way. I'm not too worried about, like, the beads. I'm always looking for new beads. I'm always buying beads. But I know if I run out of one color, like to do my spiritual dawn, if I were to, God forbid, I should run out of the colors I need for this. But if I do, and I'll show you, I'll give you another point. I like to make things in blues and purples, and I run out of those beads. I no longer have any of them. I've got some ordered, and maybe I'll be able to get them at the end of this month. Maybe. But I've got so many other colors and different designs that I do that don't even use those colors, that I can sort of afford to wait for it for a while. But that's one thing. I just love a bead store.